Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 21st, 2006. Today's session is entitled Peter the Great and the Growth of the Russian Empire, presented by Van J. Simons, SYB 2006-03. Let's listen in.
Montana. And in the spring of that year, the Mansfield Center had the opportunity to work with the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations to host a number of very influential Chinese officials that were making their way to Washington, D.C. We persuaded the center that these officials needed some downtime. What better place for downtime before they met their counterparts in Washington than Missoula? And so they landed at the Missoula airport, and a few of us picked them up, and we ran them up to Glacier Park and spent a day with them up in Glacier. The trade-off was, if we were going to host them, we felt it would be beneficial to us if we got together with these, there were about a dozen of them, a dozen officials in a formal reception and give our faculty at Montana, the president and others, a chance to interact with them. And that's what we did. And it was quite a glorious thing. But there was something very disconcerting about it. It was disconcerting because my wife and I had just spent time in China. I had gone over to give a paper in early summer of 1989. And we were, in fact, in Wuhan when the Tiananmen crisis occurred. And that following fall of 89, I had gone back to China with a group of Augustana students, and we had traveled through China, and the impressions of 1989 and the killing of all those students and all those Chinese citizens who were trying to prevent the army from getting to the square to free the square of the students that had occupied it was still very vivid in my mind. I can remember going to the square in the fall of 89, and there was no one in this wonderful open square that the Chinese pride themselves in. They had cordoned it off. There were soldiers and policemen preventing any Chinese from going in the square, lest it create an arena for another demonstration. But because we were some of the first Westerners back to China after Tiananmen, we were allowed to go into the square. And I can remember it was a very somber group of students because we had sensed what had gone on there. And when we got into this huge square, I remember we just all broke up and went our own directions to try to come to terms with what had happened in the square. And I can remember walking over to the Monument to Heroes, which is right in the center of the square, between the Temple of Heaven and Mao's mausoleum that we talked about yesterday. There's a huge kind of obelisk and a beautiful monument to the fallen. Going over there, and there were four guards up on top of the monument. And walking up, and it was cordoned off, I couldn't go up on the monument. And looking there at that and wondering what had happened, because I'd seen the footage that Ted Koppel had shown on Nightline and everything. I had a good sense of what had happened because we had been in China when it had happened just earlier. And I could see on the steps going up to the monument where the students would have hovered as the armies came in the darkness of that night, I could see the tracks of the armored personnel vehicles that had just ground through the steps as they went up the monument. And I could see bullet holes that had yet to be patched. And it was just jarring. Well, back to Montana. The officials had come now to Montana, and we were having conversations around dinner. And I can remember I was seated at one table, and the Chinese fellow who had been the former ambassador to Canada was sitting just one person away from me. Somehow the conversation had begun about the Tiananmen crisis. It was dinner time. There were three big tables, people seated around the room, and I overheard the Canadian ambassador trying to justify what had happened in Tiananmen. And you may have gathered, I'm not reticent, when when the moment for no reticence comes, if there ever is that moment. But anyway, he was feeding her the standard line. There were no students killed in Tiananmen Square. You can be assured of that. We as officials have been there. Nothing happened in Tiananmen Square. Despite the footage, you know, if you tell a big lie, Hitler said this, if you tell a big lie loud enough and long enough, people will believe it. And he was feeding that lie to this woman. And I can remember just turning to him and said, I was in China, and that is not right. What are you trying to say? And I was loud enough that everybody in the room turned, president of the university. And I can remember feeling comfortable doing that, but being a terrible host in doing that as well. And then the next day making amends to this Canadian fellow. But before the dinner ended, I had him in a corner, and he didn't like being there. And his response was, and I found this to be very interesting, it's a response that Peter would make, it's a response that Mao makes, it's a response that tyrants often make when they kill others. He said, we cannot fully know what happened that night, but I can tell you that China, on the eve of what happened on June 4th of 1989, was in chaos. And he uses the term Lun. It's a Chinese term that it doesn't translate very well into chaos or disaster. It's more frightening than that. It connotes an anarchy, that we were on the verge of anarchy. And he said, if we had not acted as we did with these students, China might have just fallen apart. The whole state might have crumbled around. And then he said, if you've not gone through the great proletarian cultural revolution, where students went out and did what they did to people of all rank and destroyed things willy-nilly, if you've not gone through the crisis that China went through from 1840 to 1949, everything from the Taiping Rebellion, where 20 million people died in the Civil War, led by the younger brother, Jesus Christ, self-proclaimed prime. I mean, China had known nothing but chaos. And he says, you should be grateful that we suppressed those students. We had no choice but to do that, because otherwise China simply. And were there not a strong authoritarian government in China, even today, he said, and this was 89 or 1991, he says, were there not that, a third of mankind would not be being fed, and the outcome of that would be that the world community would have to look out for the needs of the Chinese people. So his justification was, it's a strong government, it's a forceful government, at times, we have to take issues like this in hand. We have no choice but to do that, otherwise there'll be chaos. Okay? But that's context for what I want to talk about now. And this is the emergence of Peter the Great. Okay? We'll ultimately come back to this theme, I hope. Only 3 years after Peter assumed power as a young Tsar, and he was not much older than Kangxi was, when Kangxi assumed power. Remember, Kangxi was 15 when he worked with an uncle to displace a very powerful, another relative, Oboi was his name, when he displaced the powerful figures that were dominating his court when he was a youth. He was 15 when he assumed power. Peter the Great was 22 when he assumed power. And 3 years after that occurred, he had fought briefly a war against the Turks, was really against the Crimean Tatars, the remnants of the old Mongol realm, off to the west of, to the east of Moscow. But they were allied with the Turks, and he'd gone down to Azov, a great fortress and failed to take it, and then gone back again after he built a navy so he could, which shows the will of this young leader, and been victorious. But then he'd left for Europe, which set the whole tone for his later administration, doesn't it? But while he was gone, the Streltsy had emerged and attempted a coup d'etat. The Streltsy were old believers. They were conservative, fundamentalist Muscovites who were deeply distressed at this heretic, Peter, who would change Russia, he felt, for the better, because Russia just simply demanded change. And so allied with Peter's half-sister, Sophie, who was a half-sister because she was the daughter of Peter's father's first wife. He was the son of the Tsar's second wife. But she represented the conservative wing of court, Peter not, and the Streltsy allied with Sophie tried to seize power. They were put down very swiftly. But Peter left Vienna and nonetheless returned to Moscow. And then began a several week-long period of torture of the various Streltsy, the musketeers. This was the personal guard traditionally of the Tsars, but Peter had created his own new military force linked to the German community and foreign community in Russia. The old Streltsy now had been seized, and they were now being tortured. It's estimated that, 1,200 of the 2,000 men that were captured after they were defeated in their uprising were ultimately brutally killed, and their disfigured bodies then left around Moscow as a warning to any who would challenge Peter in the future. It was really a bloodbath. The widows and children of the Streltsy were banished from Moscow. Peter disbanded the remaining 16 Streltsy units. There had been four involved in this coup. He disbanded the remaining 16 musketeer units, seized their houses and their lands, and exiled them to Siberia. They were forbidden to ever again take up arms. And then they were replaced by Peter's Western modeled armies, led often by foreign generals instead of Russian generals. Let me read to you a little bit, if I could, to give you a sense of what all this entails. Page 266. I've tried to introduce you to one book each day that I think is particularly illuminating. The one dealt with Kangxi, one with Mao. This is the one I prefer for Peter the Great. It's a somewhat popular history, but very accessible and very well written. It was a Pulitzer Prize winner by Robert Massey. And there was a miniseries. Did any of you see that? A miniseries based on this that was really quite extraordinary about a decade ago. It probably is in the catacombs of some library somewhere that you could get hold of. But anyway, here's what is said about this. Despite the wretched forced confessions, gasped between streams or torn from groaning half-conscious men, it's a long iteration here of the various means of torture. I'm always struck by the inhumanity of men to men, the vile ways they extract confessions, meaningless confessions often from individuals. Peter learned little more than Shen, his general, had already learned. That the Streltsy had meant to seize the capital, that they were going to burn the German suburb, which Peter had now identified with, because it was Western and a threat to the old order. They would kill the boyars and ask Sophie to rule them. If she refused, they would ask the 8-year-old Tsarevich Alexis, and as a last resort, Sophie's former lover, Prince Vasily Golitsyn, for he had always been merciful to us. Peter did learn that no boyar or important member of the government or nobility had been involved in it. But nonetheless, he went ahead and brutally dealt with these officers. it was a very valid attempt, a real attempt at deposing Peter from power. The question is, did he need to act in the way he did? And I'm dealing with this question of justice and whether one needs to go to extremes to support it. Back to Kang Shi now. Those of you that were with me on Monday, who have some sense of him. This is what Kang Shi says about justice. And this is his, these are his personal words. Giving life to people and killing people, those are the powers that the emperor has. He knows that administrative errors in government bureaus can be rectified, but that a criminal who has been executed cannot be brought back to life any more than a chopped string can be joined together again. He knows, too, that sometimes people have to be persuaded into morality by the example of an execution. In 1683, after Taiwan had been captured, the court lecturers and I discussed the image of the 56 hexagram in the Book of Changes, Fire on the Mountain. The column of the mountain signifies the care that must be used in imposing penalties. The fire moves rapidly on, burning up the grass like lawsuits that should be settled speedily. My reading of this was that the ruler needs both clarity and care in punishing. His intent must be to punish in order to avoid the need for further punishing. And then he begins this long chronicle of what is extreme and what is not extreme in dealing out punishments. Let me go on just a little bit. When a commoner finally in times of war, there must be executions for cowardice or disobedience. When the city of Guchangxin fell to the rebels in the Hubei campaign in 1675, the commander-in-chief reported that General Malanga had fled. And after Prince Tsani verified this in a secret report, I had Malanga beheaded. A few months later, two more senior officers fled in the face of the enemy in Shensi, and I had them beheaded in front of their troops. Sexe was beheaded in 1697 for openly disobeying an imperial order, and so on and so forth. The final penalty of lingering death must be given in cases of treason, as the legal code requires. Chu Yongzhou was arrested and condemned for following the treacherous monk Yi Nin, for writing wild poems and deceiving the people, and for adopting false Ming reign titles. The Board of Punishments recommended that he be beheaded, but I ordered that the death be lingering, and I awarded the same punishment to another rebel. In China, the degree to which you were punished, the method that you were punished by, was determined by the egregiousness of your act. And if you were a treasonous act, then the death might be lingering. You'd be tied to a pole and just slowly sliced to death. You see, the most ideal penalty to suffer death by in the Chinese context would have been strangulation, where you're tied to a post and the executioner is behind you and he has a cord and he just suddenly tights the cord until you choke to death. That was regarded as a good punishment because your body was left intact. You weren't beheaded, you weren't sliced to pieces, your body could be buried in appropriate fashion. It was something, after all, given to you by your parents, and as a filial son or daughter, you wanted it to be whole when it was buried. Beheading was not something to be desired because you detached the head from the corpse. He goes on, I have been merciful where possible. For the ruler must always check carefully before executions and leave room for the hope that men will get better if they are given the time. In the hunt, one can kill all the animals caught inside the circle, but one can't always bear to shoot them as they stand there, trapped and exhausted. And we talked on Monday about his conscientious attention to capital punishment and how he would review several hundred documents each year at the automosticist to determine whether men should in fact be killed or not. Death can be caused by striking with fists or kicking or beating with wooden clubs. If we calculate the weight of the guilt on the basis of the weight of the murder weapon, that's bound to lead to errors being made. Take a needle, it's a tiny object, but you can't kill someone with it. But you can kill someone with it. How can you say that there is less involved because a needle is not a murder weapon? Each time when we went through the list, sparing 16 out of 63 in one season, 18 out of 57 in another, 33 out of 83 at another, so on and so forth. This was a ruler that took rulership seriously, that realized that at times when people flee in battle or treason against the state has been discovered, that there need be examples set. But unlike Peter, he didn't, I don't think, willy-nilly destroy 1,200 of 2,000 Streltsy to set an example. Any thoughts or comments about this before we move on? The theme I'm trying to address is what justifies tyranny? Or what justifies justice in an autocratic society? If you are an absolutist ruler and have the power to mete out justice, if you want to use that term, whenever you wish, to whomever you wish, when is it appropriate and when is it not?
Man, these Streltsy, these musketeers, what kind of government would they have put in place if they had succeeded in their coup?
They were going to place Peter's half-sister on the throne. They were trying as best they could to hang on to the old traditions of Russia. Peter, I'll read you a quote in just a minute, but Peter was to them an antichrist and someone who was going to move Russia into accepting things new. The best example of that was after Peter came back to Europe. He made a determination that Russia was behind times. The Russians were dressed in these long robes that were uncomfortable and not effective. They didn't give freedom of mobility that they needed, and he was going to shave everyone. He said the beard and everything was old-fashioned. And the Streltsy and Sophie's camp said, if you shave us, we'll look like monkeys or Lutherans. I've got the quote. And so it was that hanging on to the old order, you see. And so you can see where the Streltsy are coming from. Their prerequisites as the guard of Peter are being challenged by Peter's reliance on the foreign community and the creating of new units, not based on musketeering as much as cannoneering. So it's the tension between all of you.
Thank you.
I don't know where we are on this. You'll find when we talk about Lenin tomorrow, I've begun to kind of collect my thoughts for tomorrow's presentation. That there are people that said of Lenin that he is not afraid to destroy anything in the name of revolution. Lenin was a man with a vision, and the vision was to create a world community, a utopian community, based on Marxist-Leninist thought. Russia was the means by which he was going to do that, and he was not afraid to destroy the Romanov court, to destroy capitalists, to destroy anything in the path of achieving that objective. It's easy to destroy, and this will be the theme tomorrow. It's easy to destroy. It's hard to replace what you've destroyed. Here was an intellectual with absolutist power, and he was not afraid to use it. The question is, when should we use it and when not? Shall we move on?
There's one more. Your question is a very good one, but it's a very old one. Philosophically, it's taken up by Plato in Book One of the Republic between Socrates and Thrasymachus, when Thrasymachus says, well, the definition of justice is very simple. Justice is simply the advantage of the stronger. Mm. And so therefore, Peter The other emperors want to maintain their advantage, then justice is carrying out whatever is necessary to give them that advantage.
Mm-hmm. What about the struggle between a president and a Congress over the right of a president to hold prisoners incommunicado, mm-hmm. and separate from lawyers and proper trials, mm-hmm. in a place like Guantanamo? Mm-hmm.
I hope to get there, either today or tomorrow, because that's really what we're talking about in the end. You say, how does one justify one's actions? And on Monday, I think, and even yesterday, I said that democracy may not be the ideal form of government for some peoples. I said that half tongue-in-cheek, because the beauty of democracy is we can get rid of the bums, or we can at least, there are checks and balances to do that. If you have a Kang Xi, or a Peter, or a Mao, or a Lenin, there's little option. I mean, you just deal with it, because they have this absolutist power. But the same basic question comes to the fore. I've often thought, as I talk with my kids, and I'm digressing a little terribly here, but I talk with my students about the Second World War, in the trials that went on in Nuremberg and in Japan, the war criminal trials at the end of that war. The head of the Air Force during the Second World War was, what was his name? Escapes me. He became a vice presidential candidate later on in the early 70s.
Curtis
LeMay, yes. Curtis LeMay once observed that had we lost the war, we would all have been tried as war criminals. Justice is defined by who has power. And he was referring to the fact that 65 of Japan's cities had been firebombed, which was an extension of raw power beyond anything imaginable before that Second World War occurred. We just simply, but he made a statement that war is a process by which you break down an enemy. And when you kill enough of them, they stop fighting. And that was the formula. And it's disconcerting to think about that. But we can put, it's World War II, isn't it? That where America emerges as the great imperialist power, contested for a period of time by the Soviet Union, but now by no other. And the question is, will we be able to manage that power in a way that is appropriate? In looking at the question of autocracy and why it emerges in some countries and why it doesn't in others, a very respected scholar, Richard Pipes, presents a deterministic formula for why in Russia we find autocracy, why there are the Peters, and before Peters, the various dynastic rulers of the Rurik house instead of the Romanov house. And he says it's all due to geography. Some of you know Norm Moline, a geographer at Augie. Norm would like this. That geography determines, it fates, that Russia will be autocratic. Why do you think that would be the case? Why would Richard Pipes say that geography determines that Russia's autocratic? I'm fishing here. It's sometimes hard to know what I'm fishing for.
Depends on whether you're talking about a smaller Russia or...
I'm talking about a large
Russia. How could you ever control Russia?
Okay. One reason he'd say is poor communications, the expanse of Russia, if you're going to hold this unwieldy multinational empire together. And Peter's the one that makes it that. You've got to have autocratic government, a forceful government that can deal with it. It has even something even more than that. It's closer to the environment we live in. The harshness of Russian geography, he says, led to autocratic government. The growing season was so short, the agricultural methods so primitive, that unless there was a centralized government that enabled the great landholders of Russia to insurf the peasants and mobilize their labor to plant the crops in the very short period of time they had for planting. Mobilize the people so they can get the crops in, and the crops can grow and be harvested before the next frost comes. The Russians could not have survived. So it's the harshness of the ecology, of the weather, he says, that contributed to that.
Are you saying that certain people or certain locations are inherently, permanently incapable of democracy, or simply that at the present stage of their development, it's not appropriate for them?
Good for you for picking up on
that. A good question.
It's a good question. What I'm saying is the Russia of Peter the Great, according to Richard Pipes. He's a very famous historian. I'll be quoting from him tomorrow with Lenin. He's a famous Russian scholar at Harvard, now retired. But he argues that in the Russia of Peter, autocracy was the only option because of the nature. That needn't be the case today because of the revolution and agronomy and communications and everything else. But he says that that accounts for the autocrat of Peter. And then he says the other key factor was the threat constantly posed to Russia by nomadic incursion. Not so much by Western Europe as by the Mongols, or well, it would have been the Scythians and Sarmatians and then the Mongols and other Turkic people. The eastern frontier of Russia, from the Urals west, but particularly through that little corridor down by the Caspian Sea, was always vulnerable to nomadic attack. And you needed an authoritarian government that could wield the power, that could mount the troops to defend the frontier. Interesting to think about that, isn't it? That autocracy may, in fact, be geographically determined. We raised the question earlier. Did you bring your book, Ruth? We raised the question earlier whether heroes make history. We're talking about, five great figures in history, and we wondered if whether they're just part of an unfolding process that's deterministic, or whether, in fact, they, by their own volition, by their own strong will, Peter had it, Mao had it, surely, whether they chart the course of history. Here's what Leo Tolstoy said in War and Peace about determinism. In historical events, great men, so-called, are but the labels that serve to give a name to an event. And like labels, they have the last possible connection with the event itself. Every action of theirs that seems to them an act of their own free will is in an historical sense not free at all, but in bondage to the whole course of previous history and predestined from all eternity.
What about Alexander the Great? I don't think Alexander the Great had to happen.
You don't think he had to happen?
No. And the classicism of the ancient world that became part of that as a result of those.
I agree. I think men do, by their own volition, make history. I think we all feel that way. Well, what would be our purpose in being if in some little way we didn't shape history? But my wife and I were talking the other day, what if we had stayed in Montana and raised the kids there instead of Iowa? How would they have been shaped differently? How would we have been shaped? We are shaped by our environment. We are shaped by deterministic factors. But one likes to think that we also shape events ourselves, don't we? Yes?
But wasn't Tolstoy's point that the one at the top with the most power was the most determined, mystically?
I would suggest the most able to determine the course of event.
Well, was most,
most shaped by
that the determinism most affected the one at the top, and the one at the bottom had more actual freedom.
You think so?
I thought that's what Tolstoy said, but it's been decades since I read it.
Every action of theirs. I don't know whether he's referring to one or the other as much as he is to everyone. In historical events, great men, so he's talking about great men, so-called, are but the labels that serve to give a name to an event. And like labels, they have the last possible connection with the event itself. Every action of theirs that seems to them an act of their own free will is an historical sense not free at all, but in bondage to the whole course of previous history, predestined from all eternity. Tomorrow, I'll talk about World War I and World War II and the impact of these wars on history and the fact that those who orchestrated the unfolding of the wars never, ever contemplated what their results would be, which suggests the wars had their own kind of determined forces, that the great generals played a little role in the end. I don't know. It's worth exploring. There are other, by the way, deterministic theories of history. Pipe says it's geography that determined the course of Russian history. Have any of you heard of Carl Wittfogel? I come in contact with him because I'm a Chinese historian. He says that hydraulics determined the course of history. That in China, there was autocratic government because of the need to control water. You had these two great river systems running through China, the Yellow River and the Yangtze River. The Chinese civilization emerges in the Yellow River, and it was flood prone. It was, even back then, a mighty river, full of siltation and constantly flooding. And the only way the Chinese could survive was to harness that river, to prevent it from flooding, and then to funnel the waters through elaborate irrigation systems into rice paddies for the production of rice. And that could only occur if there was an authoritarian government that could organize the peasants to control those waters. And then to prove his point, he says, and look at the Nile, or look at the Tigris and Euphrates, or look at the Indus River. All of those great rivers gave birth to great autocratic systems of government, and he argues that it was hydraulics that. It's an interesting question, but having raised it, I want to get back to Peter because that's what we're supposed to be talking about. Let me spend a little bit of time introducing you to this quite remarkable man. And I'm going to do it in part because I wanted to do this by comparing Peter to Kangxi, this contemporary, this Chinese contemporary. I suggested to you on the board that Peter reigned from 1682 to 1725. How does he die? 1682 to 1725. How does he die? It's an appropriate death. Heroically. He jumps into an ice-laden body of water to save a sailor, and then comes out and dies of pneumonia a few days later. This was a man. I've got a description of him. Let me see if I can find that in my text here. This was a man who was almost 7 feet tall in his time period. He was a man that was just larger than life. Page 184. He was only somewhat educated because the faction that he was part of, the Nrishkin family, when he was young, was had been shunted aside by Sophie's family, and he was just, they were sent out of the capital so they wouldn't meddle in politics, and he mostly as a kid just did things that he wanted to do, no formal training. Kangxi, on the other hand, you see, was formally trained in a palace school, and though his native language was Manchu, he was very capable in writing Chinese. He learned Mongolian and other nomadic language so he could work with those that who were part of his empire. Peter didn't have a formal education, but like Kangxi, he was eclectic in his approach to study. He just consumed information. And so when he goes to Europe, he picks up Dutch and becomes the translator for other people in his group. He had a very quick mind. Here's a description of Peter given by Sophia Charlotte, the electress, I think it was of Hanover. The Tsar is very tall, his features are fine, and his figure very noble. He has great vivacity of mind and a ready and just repartee. But with all the advantages with which nature has endowed him, it could be wished that his manners were a little less rustic. He took pride in being rustic. We immediately sat down to at the table. Herr Koppenstein, who did the duty as marshal, presented the napkin to His Majesty, who was greatly embarrassed, for at Brandenburg, instead of a table napkin, they had given him a ewer and basin to clean his hands after the meal. He was very gay, very talkative, and we established a great friendship for each other, and he exchanged snuff boxes with my daughter. We stayed, in truth, a very long time at table, but we would gladly have remained there longer still without feeling a moment of boredom, for the Tsar is very good humor and never ceased talking to us. He was a very gregarious, outgoing person, and very self-confident and very engaging. My daughter had her Italians sing. Their song pleased him, though he confessed to us that he did not care much for music. I asked him if he liked hunting. He replied that his father had been very fond of it, but that he himself, from his earliest youth, had had a real passion for navigation and fireworks. Have you heard the story of Peter? When he was young, what he did was he created, at Preobrashensky, where his family lived, a guards unit. He was a co-emperor of Russia, but his half-brother, dominated by Sophie, was the real power. And he was just off doing his thing. And so off doing his thing, he hung out with the people from the foreign quarters that were serving the Russian state. A lot of Germans in the group. And he created his toy armies, but they weren't toy armies. They were really real soldiers. And they would build fortifications, and they'd bring in cannon, and they'd blow things up. He learned military warfare as a kid by doing military warfare. When he fails to take Azov in the first campaign against the Turks, he fails because Azov was a fortification that was provisioned by sea. And all he had, because he was Russian Tsar, was land armies. And Russia at that time had no access to the Baltic, no access to the Black Sea. They were landbound, basically. They had no need for a navy. So failing to take Azov, he went back up the Dnieper River and built a navy. And next year went down and took Azov. He was a hands-on, what do we call this, empiricist? He just learned by doing things. And he had the resources to do it. So here he was. He replied that his father had been very fond of it, but that he himself, from his earliest youth, had had a real passion for navigation and fireworks. He told us that he worked himself in building ships, showed us his hands, and made us touch the callous places that had been caused by work. He brought his musicians, and they played Russian dances, which we liked better than the Polish ones. We regretted that we could not stay much longer, so that we could see him again, for his society gave us much pleasure, and on and on. It gives you a sense of Peter. He was an engaging fellow, a person larger than life, but to many an antichrist because of the direction he took the Russian people. He assumed the throne at 22, Kangxi at 15. Peter's role was different than Kangxi's role. What was Kangxi's role? Do you remember, Nick? What was the role of Kangxi as emperor? Were you here the first day? I know you were here yesterday. He was a Qing ruler, and what was his charge more than anything else? He was son of heaven, yeah, to adopt that mantle. And he immediately found himself, you see, involved, engaged in justifying his alien rule. He was a Manchu dominating a Chinese state. And so he dressed in the mantle of a son of heaven. His charge was to validate his rule. And so he spends a lot of time courting the Chinese so they'll serve his state. A lot of time building an empire, which we talked about. What was Peter's charge? To drag Russia willy-nilly into the Western world. And they were very uncomfortable doing that. But he did it nonetheless. To establish, what is the rest of his legacy? A port on the Baltic, St. Petersburg. He builds a capital in swampland, and it becomes St. Petersburg, Leningrad, after Lenin assumes power. To gain a toehold on the Black Sea at the expense of the Turks, to expand Russia into Siberia, which he does. Ultimately, it's not Peter, it only happens in the 19th century, securing Vladivostok, not an ice-free port, but almost one on the Pacific. So he accomplishes a great deal. Let me read to you. This will give you a sense, because we have all kinds of time constraints. This will give you a sense of what Peter accomplished, the ever-practical Peter, the utilitarian Peter, the empiricist Peter. He didn't spend a lot of time learning from books. He just did things, and they happened. This is what a Russian historian says of Peter. Yes, Peter the Great did much for Russia. Now we're asking, is this a hero of history, or did these things just happen because geography determined they would? Okay. Yes, Peter the Great did much for Russia. One looks and one does not believe it. One keeps adding and one cannot reach the sun. We cannot open our eyes, cannot make a move, cannot turn in any direction without encountering him everywhere, at home, in the streets, in church, in school, in court, in the regiment, at a promenade. It is always he, every day, every minute, at every step. Now here is achievements. We wake up. What day is it? January 1st, 1841. Peter the Great ordered us to count years from the birth of Christ. Peter the Great ordered us to count the months from January. He changed the traditional Muscovite calendar. It is time to dress. Our clothing is made according to the fashion established by Peter the First, our uniform according to his model. The cloth is woven in a factory which he created. The wool is shorn from sheep which he started to raise. That's dramatic, huh? A book strikes our eyes. Peter the Great introduced this script and himself cut out the letters. You began to read it. This language became a written language, a literary language at the time of Peter the First, superseding the earlier church language. So he drags them into a whole new literary world and a new written script. Newspapers are brought in. Peter the Great introduced them. You must buy different things. They all, from the silk neckerchief to the sole of your shoe, will remind you of Peter the Great. Some were ordered by him. Others were brought into use or improved by him, carried on his ships, into his harbors, on his canals, on his roads. Peter did much to build the infrastructure of Russia. Why? Why was he concerned about infrastructure? Because all but 1 year of Peter's life, his reign, it's 25 and 17, 37 years, is it? All but one of those years he spent fighting battles. He was constantly at war, and he needed the infrastructure. He needed the ships and the canals and the roadways to get his troops from the Swedish border to the Polish border to the Crimea and so on and so forth. We'll talk a little bit about his wars in a minute. At dinner, all the courses, from salted herring through potatoes, which he ordered grown, to wine made from grapes, which he began to cultivate, will speak to you of Peter the Great. After dinner, you drive out for a visit. There is an assembly of Peter the Great. You meet the ladies there. They were admitted into masculine company by order of Peter the Great. Let us go to the university. The first secular school was founded by Peter the Great. You receive a rank according to Peter the Great's table of ranks. The old order in Moscow had been defined by the old boyars and the old nobility, and it was steeped in tradition, and Peter just broke that down. He wanted to create a meritorious government. He wanted to promote people based on their contributions to his military and his governance, and so he created a new table of ranks. The rank gives me gentry status. Peter the Great so arranged it. I must file a complaint. Peter the Great prescribed its form. It will be received in front of Peter the Great's mirror of justice. He revised the court systems. It will be acted upon on the basis of the general regalement. You decide to travel abroad, following the example of Peter the Great. you will be received well. Peter the Great placed Russia among the European states and began to instill respect for her, and so on and so on and so on. If you want to use the term hero in history, think of all that he contributed. And I think that's only part of it. Many scholars say that the most notable achievement of Peter was to build St. Petersburg. Have any of you been there? Isn't it a glorious place?
Absolutely.
And it was made in a swamp. Why? Because he needed a port on the Baltic. Why? Because he wanted to force the Russian people to begin to look westward. Before Peter became the emperor of Russia, Russian diplomacy was terribly, woefully backward. You read about it. Russians, they had really no diplomatic office. When they traveled to Europe, they did so under the guise of the church. They would only work directly with a king of another state. Never diplomatic office to diplomatic office. They would work only in the Russian language. It was a cumbersome diplomacy that it was indulged in at all. When Peter goes abroad, if you've ever read about Peter, as he goes abroad, he's just consuming everything as he goes. It really is quite amazing. He goes to Holland and is welcomed there. And why does he go to Holland first? Because he needs a navy, and he's heard the Dutch have the best navy. And he goes there, but very quickly decides that the British are more powerful militarily, and he abandons Holland and goes over to England. But the first thing he does when he gets to Holland and then to England, he signs up as a ship's carpenter. And he goes and lives in a small little house, and he works with his hands. He wants to see how ships are built, and he starts from the bottom up. That was the nature of this fellow. Quite a remarkable individual. The challenge was to westernize, despite the unwillingness of people to do so. I want to give you a sense of Peter as a student, his form of learning. So let me read to you. This is from a basic text by Ryazanovsky, which I feel is the best that's been written on the whole course of Russian history. The Tsar had an insatiable intellectual curiosity coupled with an amazing ability to learn. He proceeded to participate personally in all kinds of state affairs, technical and special as well as general, becoming deeply involved in diplomacy, administration, justice, finance, commerce, industry, education, and practically everything else besides. In his reforms, the Tsar invariably valued expert advice, but he was also generally independent in thought and did not hesitate to adapt projects to circumstances. Peter I also developed into an accomplished military and naval commander. He studied the professions of soldier and sailor from the bottom up. He didn't start in the military as a general. He insisted on starting as a private and working his way up, serving first in the ranks and learning the use of each weapon before promoting himself to the first post as an officer. The monarch attained the rank of full general after the victory of Poltava. That was an incredible victory. And a full admiral after the successful conclusion of the Great Northern War. That was fought, of course, against the Swedes. In addition, the sovereign found time to learn some 20 different trades and prided himself on his ability to make almost everything, from a ship to a pair of shoes. With his own hands, he pulled the teeth of his courtiers and cut off their beards. You volunteered for that, I think. Characteristically, he wanted to do everything and see everything for himself, traveling indefatigably around his vast state as no Muscovite monarch had ever done. In a still more unprecedented manner, he went twice to the West to learn in 1697-98 and in 1717-17. He's quite an impressive fellow. What Peter spent much of his life doing was breaking out of the constraints of the court and the old system. And it took a man of great energy to be able to do that. He was able to do that because he relied on mostly non-Russians in Russia to help him break out of that situation, and did so effectively. I've got 15 minutes. Let's talk a little bit about one other conundrum or dilemma that autocrats face, and that is the question of succession. You know, we've talked about the value of democracy as opposed to autocracy, and autocracy can be defined as imperial autocracy or the autocracy that comes with a dictatorship or whatever. What is always a challenge is the struggle to either succeed yourself or to find someone who succeeds you as a ruler. We've talked briefly about Peter and the problem he had in assuming power. And it was a problem that was created because Tsar Alexis, his father, had married twice. His first wife was Mary Miloslavskaya, and she lived from 1648 to 1660, well, was queen or empress from 1648 to 1669. And then as she passed away, and Nathalie Naryshkina was Peter's mother, lived until, lived beyond Alexis died in 76. There were 13 children by Alexis's first wife, from 48 to 69, 13 children. Only two of those sons survived. Both were sickly. And that creates a problem because neither was really prepared to rule. Peter, born of the second wife, was strong, healthy, alert, and a threat then to this other family. He was born in 1672. When Alexis died, one of these two sickly sons succeeded him, Theodore. But he died very shortly after, which left an even more sickly son to share power with Peter. The two families resolved the succession dilemma by agreeing to share power. There would be co-czars, that never works in an autocracy, and it didn't work, because very quickly, the Naryshkina family of Peter assumed full power, aided by the patriarch and the foreign community. But then they were quickly deposed by a coup orchestrated by the Streltsy, this nemesis of Peter, and the conservatives at court. Peter, as a young boy, witnessed many in his family killed by the Streltsy as this coup was staged. And maybe his harshness in dealing with the musketeers in the end came from witnessing the bloodshed when the Miloslavsky family took over. Sophie made a mistake, though. She's the regent to the young Tsar, the inept, incapable Tsar, her brother. She's the regent to the Tsar. She made a mistake in launching a war against the Crimean Tatars that fails, and that led to her fall from power and then Peter's emergence. There was trouble, you see, in sorting out who would reign. And when Peter dies, the same kind of trouble exists. There was a chaotic period of five different rulers in a 50-year period of time before Catherine the Great emerges, a German princess to a Russian czar, and there's stability again. In autocracies, you have that problem. Kangxi, remember this emperor I told you about? Kangxi, I think I told you, had 30 consorts and 56 children. And the question was which of his children would succeed him in rulership. And the fact that there were a number of claimants didn't make life easy. Kangxi had only one son of an empress. And he very quickly named that boy, Yinzhang was his name, to be the heir apparent. He was bright as a young boy and seemed capable. But by the time Yin Zheng reached his teenage years, Kangxi discovered that there were qualities in this boy that he did not like. And word came back that this boy was capricious, overbearing. There was rumor that he was that he had a tendency seizing young boys to commit homosexual acts with them. He was violent and had a terrible temper. And as remember, Kangxi ruled for 61 years. And here Yin Zheng is waiting for his turn. And it looks like his father's never going to die. And Kangxi began to think, in fact, that that Yin Zheng might have been center stage in a conspiracy to assassinate him. Succession was a problem. And so what Kangxi does is he orders the arrest of Yin Zheng and imprisons him. You didn't want to be in a Chinese prison at this time, despite the justice of Kangxi. The prison, I mean, torture was practiced. 17th century world was a place you didn't want to be imprisoned anywhere. Yin Zheng survives for a short period of time. And then Kangxi is informed that perhaps Yin Zheng isn't that bad, and his heart really was with this boy and the stability that would come if he assumed power. And so he releases Yin Zheng from prison and reinstates him, and then goes off to campaign against this Mongol leader, Galdun, but is informed that while he's gone, Yin Zheng may in fact be conspiring to overthrow him again. So he orders him in prison, and his son, his chosen heir, dies probably of torture in prison. Kangxi never solved the succession crisis. He had a half dozen capable young sons by other consorts who could replace him as ruler, but he didn't have the heart to name anyone because he had failed in his first effort. And he was afraid that, well, you'd think that in naming an heir apparent that would have ended what was becoming a fratricidal struggle amongst the various possible claimants to replace their father when he died, but he didn't have the heart to do that. So when Kangxi dies, there is no heir apparent that's been designated. And there was a deep-seated battle, really, between the sons of various wives and consorts to assume power, all allied with various factions of eunuchs and scholar officials. And out of that emerges one emperor, Yongzheng. It was only Yongzheng who figured it out. And when Kangxi dies and Yongzheng replaces him, Yongzheng says, I am not going to have the same problem my father did. I will choose an heir apparent, but I'll not name him. Therefore, he won't become, my sons won't become egotistical and proud. And rather, I'll choose him. And then if any of you have been to the Forbidden City, there was there's a great hall, the second of three halls in the Forbidden City complex, where audiences of tributaries are held. In a box overlooking that throne, he put the name of his heir apparent, not to be opened until his death. And that is all that throne. Well, we've been talking then about autocracy, the goods and the ills of autocracy. The good, are there any? In Kangxi or in Peter?
Order.
Order. Well, stability, yeah. Perhaps. Depending on the viability of the autocrat. In Peter and in Kangxi, you had leaders that could create stability and order. When they pass away, unless fortuitously a Yongzheng follows, you can have chaos, and that's what happens in Russia. What else? What other advantages come from?
Rapid execution of orders.
Okay. You can make decrees, and Russia can be dragged against its will into a Western world, right? That would not have happened as quickly had there not been a Peter. It may have happened. Tolstoy may have been right. Russia would ultimately have moved that direction. Before Peter comes, it was moving that way despite itself, because that's where so much development was occurring. So that's a second possible benefit. Any others?
Well, the people felt secure, even maybe if they were afraid, they were fed and they felt secure, like they could live their lives.
Let's go back to my opening remarks from the former Chinese consulate to Canada. He said, had we not acted, there would have been chaos. We as Americans or Canadians or people that have been blessed by being in countries that have democracy, we take stability for granted for the most part. But if you're in a developing country or a country that's only known civil war, or a country that's never been able quite to feed its people, there comes a point where stability seems more important than democracy. Having food seems of greater importance than democracy. And you begin to ask that question of the stability that comes. Remember, I think I did on Monday, my geography teacher saying that the Philippine people have been blessed by Ferdinand Marcos. This was back when I was a student. And he was a dictator, for sure. But he said, look at the instability in the rest of Southeast Asia and the stability the Filipinos have with Marcos. They have food on the table, more so than some other countries and so on and so forth. Now, on the scale of things, it's fair that the former consul to Canada makes that statement. And it's unfair of us, perhaps, to be too cavalier in rejecting that, to being too quick to suppose, as some people in our country do today, I'll be upfront here, that democracy is the panacea for the ills of every people in every country in this world. Maybe there's a halfway point somewhere in between. Democracy itself is wasteful. I mean, look at the, as opposed to a structured, organized movement towards stability. We need to ask these kinds of questions. I'll do that tomorrow when we talk about Lenin. Lenin is going to be appalled. This is a man who wanted to was willing to destroy everything to accomplish his objective. And he manages to do that. And then before he dies, when does he die? 1924. Only a few years after the Russian Revolution. And by the time he dies, less than a decade after he's assumed power, he's completely disillusioned with what has been created. His dream was not realized, either for Russia or in the international arena of things. It's much easier to destroy things through war than it is to create something to follow. I think Bush and Cheney and Rice and those people are finding that out. You can overthrow a tyrant, but what do you place in his stead? And through what pains do you go in doing so? Lenin found that out. Mao found that out. Autocrats find that out. And we'll explore that tomorrow towards the end of the discussion. Thanks for your time. We'll talk about Lenin.